kulture sećanja u dijalogu. Slušate podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.
This is Memory Cultures in Dialogue, the podcast of the Humanitarian Law Center from Belgrade. My name is Jelena Đurejinović. Why do people participate in genocide? What motivates the individuals to become perpetrators? For many of us working on conflict and post-conflict settings around the world, this question has always been a puzzle. My today's guest, Timothy Williams, has dedicated a lot of attention to this question and to the study of perpetrators. He just published the book, The Complexity of Evil, Perpetration and Genocide, that offers a model for understanding the conditions that lead to perpetration, focusing on low-level perpetrators. In other words, the individuals who actually implemented genocide. The book uses the example of Cambodia, the Holocaust, and Rwanda, but today we will be mostly talking about the genocide and its perpetration in Cambodia, as well as the process of transitional justice and memory. In Cambodia, during the Khmer Rouge regime between 1975 and 1979, around 2 million people died. Many were executed, but many also died from starvation, diseases, and overwork. The genocide was not ethnically driven, but the killings were directed against ethnic Khmer, who were defined as political enemies. Hi, Tim. Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation.
Hi, thank you so much for the invitation to speak to you.
Let's start by talking a bit about perpetrator studies. Why is it important to study perpetrators, to look at their perspective and to understand them?
I think that it's really important to study perpetrators because to understand violence, to understand mass violence, to understand genocide, what we're really trying to do is to understand the dynamics. And we can only really understand the consequences of that violence, which is so tragic, by looking at the people who are enacting the violent acts themselves, and that is the perpetrators. Now, it's obviously not the easiest to study, both from a sort of an emotional point of view, to engage with the perspectives of the people who are carrying out these horrific crimes. And it's also methodologically not the easiest. But I do think that it gives us a different kind of insight that we can't get by just studying the violent outcomes, nor by studying the victims. And at the same time, I think it's also important to think about perpetrators in order to think about prevention. If we want to prevent violence, what we need to do is to prevent people enacting this violence. And so we'll only do that by able to understand them.
So what are the fundamental assumptions of the complexity of evil model that you introduce in your new book?
So basically, what I've tried to do in the book is to look at the many different motivations and factors that lead to people participating in genocide. And I differentiate between different types of factors that can push people towards participating. I differentiate between motivations, facilitative factors, and contextual conditions. And what that means is motivations are the actual impetus why someone would participate. Without a motivation, people don't participate. Facilitative factors, they're factors which make it easier for someone to participate, but on their own, they don't necessarily push someone, or they can't push someone to participate. And the contextual conditions are just the larger context in which it happens. And so by bringing these together, what I try to do is explain why people participate as a form of action. So it doesn't explain them as perpetrators, as human beings, but in a specific moment in time, why they act in this specific way.
You mentioned motivations. So could you summarize in a way, why do people participate in genocide? What are their motivations? What different types of motivations there are?
So I differentiate between three main groups of motivations. There are in-group motivations, which focus on dynamics within the perpetrator in-group. Out-group motivations, which focus on the out-group of the victims and responses to those victims, and opportunistic motivations, which derive their power through the benefit that the perpetrators hope to get from their action. And in-group motivations start with these, about social dynamics within the group. It can be both vertical, in the sense that an authority gives an order and perpetrator then responds to this through obedience and thus participates, but it can also be horizontal when pressures are exerted by friends or comrades. And so it could be peer pressure or people wanting to be conform with their group to keep up with the other people and not be seen as different. At the same time, in both the horizontal and the vertical ways, besides implicit or more explicit pressures, also coercion can play a role where threats or actual violence is exerted if people don't participate. But I think one of the most interesting factors within the perpetrator in-group is the idea of taking on a role. So when someone joins a group, there are certain expectations put towards them of how they should act. And one of my interviewees in Cambodia put it this way. He said that when he was entering the tiger zone, he realized that he had to become a tiger, to become cruel like them. And so that, as a quote for me, is really powerful because it basically says that he understands that there's a certain role that he takes on and that there are certain expectations of him of how he now has to act. And that includes killing other people as this kind of tiger. So as you can tell, a lot of these factors are very social psychological. They're about the mental reactions of people to their relations to other people within the perpetrator group.
What about the out-group and what you call opportunistic motivations? Could you explain that and maybe give us some kind of example from your research in Cambodia?
Outgroup motivations, like I said, they focus on the victim group. And so this is emotional and ideological responses to the victims. So both fear or hatred or resentment of the victims could be emotional responses. And ideologies are sort of the clearest, really. This is what, when we first think about genocide, we think of people who hate the victim group for some kind of ideological reason, be it anti-Semitism during the Holocaust or a hatred of communists in Indonesia. But actually, interestingly, relatively few people, the ideology is the actual motivation, the actual reason why they participate. And ideologies actually take on other forms of influence more often. So they would be what I call facilitative factors more often, where it provides a framework in which the killing becomes legitimate, becomes justifiable, becomes rationalizable. And so these justifications serve to make the killing thinkable and committable, but the reason they're actually doing it are these other motivations, like in-group, out-group, or opportunistic motivations. And so the opportunistic motivations, there are a lot of different types of benefit that people can get out of it. The most obvious is probably economic benefits. So if you participate, you could be paid for your participation. This was quite common, say, in the genocide against the Armenians, where people were paid by the amount of people they'd killed. But you can also, through looting, through stealing off the victim group, also gain economic benefits. But people also hope for career progression by participating. People who are particularly enthusiastic killers are often awarded promotions, was told to me during my interviews. Personal conflicts, where people are targeted because of old grudges, which have nothing to do with the genocide, but are sort of fought out under this idea of the genocide, justified through the genocide. One of the sort of the core reasons people joined the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia was because they hoped for their own personal security. They thought that if they were Khmer Rouge, they were more likely to stay safe. If you were from the ethnic majority and you were a member of the Khmer Rouge, you were actually more likely to die. But the motivation to be part of the group is still there through security or through better access to food. There was mass starvation, like you mentioned earlier, in Cambodia during the late 1970s. And so being part of the killing groups gave you access to better food, to more rest than you would have had in other parts of the population.
You also bring up what you already mentioned, the facilitative factors that alone don't really make someone participate in genocide, but they are nevertheless very important. So could you explain what are these facilitative factors? You mentioned, for example, ideology. What is the role of ethnicity, for example? Where do you place that in this model?
So facilitative factors, besides ideologies and sort of justification mechanisms, would also include kind of the opposite, moral disengagement is what I call it, where people try and morally separate themselves from the act. So for instance, by dehumanizing the victims through saying they're no longer human, through animalizing them, that's one way to morally disengage, through creating distance to the victims, be it physical or emotional or social distance. This is an easy way to make it easier to participate. Again, it's not the reason they're doing it, but it makes it easier. And here, for instance, ethnicity also plays a role. By highlighting the differentness of ethnic groups, you're able to create a social distance between the groups. And you're also able to reinforce in-group dynamics, which were key for the motivations, but also group dynamics play a part in facilitative factors. When you're able to diffuse responsibility, for instance, when acting in a group or in a hierarchical setting, you can displace the responsibility upwards to an authority and not feel like it's actually your responsibility for acting. And the last sort of category of facilitative factors are time-based. So through participating over time, you can become more desensitized. You can become, there can be sort of escalation dynamics as well, which make it easier to participate. But ethnicity, I would say, while it does play into distance, its main role as part of the constellation of contextual conditions, which is my third larger category, because ethnicity is most important in terms of as being a categorization mechanism. So it allows people to understand society in specific ways. So it plays into large national ideologies, but it plays into the way that people see their society and the state. And so ethnicity is a way for people to understand the world, and then the ideologies can feed into that, and they can take these ethnic categorizations and use these, and it feeds then into them either having an emotional response or understanding who is killable and who is not killable, even if the ethnicity itself doesn't necessarily have to take on a huge degree of meaning.
I asked you specifically about ethnicity because I think for most of our listeners, this would be the first thing they would think of when thinking about genocide. So could you maybe shortly explain for maybe some of our listeners who don't know the case studies that you used, particularly the ethnicity and the role it played in, for example, the genocide in Rwanda? Because in Cambodia, it is, of course, it doesn't play such an important role.
In Cambodia, indeed, there were ethnic minorities who were killed and who were identified as ethnic minorities and suffered in specifically ethnicized ways. The Muslim Cham, for instance, were sort of persecuted in very specific ways as well. But ethnicity in Rwanda, for instance, is very important because it identifies who is a Hutu, who is a Tutsi. But all the work recently on perpetrators shows that ethnicity isn't really central in motivating people to participate, but instead is used as this kind of categorization mechanism. Leanne Fuji has this really excellent way of describing it as a script in which state-sponsored ethnicity is basically given, distributed around the country as something like a playbook, and this script. And then in the local level, local elites will act as directors and participants will act as actors and bring this script to life and infuse it with different meanings and different performances. Using this metaphor, performances in these different places. And I think this is a really helpful way of thinking about ethnicity, that it's really important and it's the script through which things are enacted, but what it means and why people are acting within it differ from place to place.
You spent, during your research, you spent months in Cambodia doing fieldwork, and you did also 58 interviews with former Khmer Rouge who participated in the genocide in the 70s. Before I ask you about doing this kind of fieldwork and the difficulties and challenges for the researcher, I would actually first ask you, again, I think some of our listeners would really appreciate the explanation, who are these people? Who are the perpetrators in Cambodia? What kind of people, how it happened? Did they participate in genocide in their own villages and towns?
Yeah, so most of the vast majority of perpetrators in Cambodia were people who came from an agricultural background. The vast majority of the population had an agricultural background in the 1970s, but they were peasants, farmers, generally had a couple of years of education, but not much more than that. And they then became wrapped up with the Khmer Rouge pre-genocidal, as it were, before, for the most part, before they took power in the country, in the context of a civil war, in which the beginning in 1970, King Sihanouk was toppled, and the new prime minister allowed Americans in the Vietnam War to bomb the eastern parts of Cambodia. And this was the real sort of starting point for the Khmer Rouge, because people, hundreds of thousands of people died, and many more millions lost their livelihoods to the American bombs, which this new prime minister had allowed. And so the old king, who had been toppled, called on people to go to the jungles and join the revolution. So this is really unholy alliance between a monarch and communists, which you don't normally get. So it's very symbolic of pragmatic Cambodian politics. And so many people were encouraged by their parents, by their friends, to go into the jungles and join the Khmer Rouge to fight back against this oppression. But when in 1975, in April, then the Khmer Rouge took power, they then started implementing their Maoist ideology, which most people didn't really know about when they signed up. And actually, it went against a lot of the people's ideas of what they really wanted, because they were peasants, but they often weren't, it wasn't like in many other countries where they were dependent on landowners. They actually owned small holdings themselves. So being collectivized was actually part of the trauma for many of the people I spoke to. But they then, within the positions that they were in, were very often sent to other parts of the country. And there, if they were part of a militia or part of the security system, they would then also be a part of executions and part of arresting. But generally, it was an extremely totalitarian regime. And once you were part of it, once you were assigned a role, you didn't really have much of a choice. And in that transition period, also many people joined the Khmer Rouge because they hoped they would be safer. And after that, it was basically everyone was assigned a task in the entire country. And if you were assigned to become a Khmer Rouge, that's who you became. So there's very little agency and very little political ideology behind joining the Khmer Rouge. So it's very different to in other cases.
Слушате подкаст Фонда за хуманитарно право. Културе сечења у диалогу.
Tell us now a bit about your fieldwork that you did there and about studying perpetrators in Cambodia, especially that the genocide happened in the 70s and you did these interviews decades later, which probably is quite different than doing interviews and doing fieldwork about perpetrators of a genocide that happened 20 years ago, for example.
I'm not sure there's a big difference between 20 years and 40 years, but there's definitely, with either of them, a big problem of people having memory bias, of many people having died or moved away. Basically, it was quite challenging to find people to speak to. For the most part, my plan had been to, I had contact through an NGO to a few people and then to snowball from there and ask them for connections to people they'd been part of the Khmer Rouge with in time. But actually, very few people today have any contact with people who they were Khmer Rouge with in the past. And that's partly because everyone was transferred to different parts of the country after they were recruited. And then after the end of Democratic Cambodia, they either went home or they fled to the Thai border. So there was very little contact. But also it's because during the Khmer Rouge period, in an absolutely totalitarian system with strong denunciations, it's not very helpful for creating strong social bonds between your comrades when you're supposed to be denouncing each other and looking out for internal enemies. So that strategy didn't really work. But we were able to, my research assistant and colleague Kiao Duong and I were able to find 58 different people. It took us a good 6 months. And almost all of them today are also involved in agriculture and live in the provinces. And of course, much has happened in the last 40 years. There's been a two-decade civil war since. There's been autocratic regime. And of course, they had many, many different issues. But the genocide and the Democratic Cambodia is obviously very much still marked in people's minds. But people were relatively welcoming and prepared to talk to me about it anyway.
Does that have something to do with the fact that they actually perceive themselves as victims, their readiness to talk to you?
Definitely. So I didn't realize the degree of this when I started working in Cambodia and how lucky I was. But most people who I spoke to either explicitly or at least implicitly see themselves as victims of the Khmer Rouge because of the totalitarian nature of the violence, because so many Khmer Rouge were killed. And so from their perspective, I didn't come to them and say, you're a perpetrator, would you like to talk to me? I was interested in their stories. I was interested in their perspectives. And so they were quite happy to talk to me because they wanted to tell me about their lives and their experiences under the Khmer Rouge. And they were also prepared to talk to me about violence and the things they had done, because this is part of their victimization experience. For them, having been forced to arrest people, to beat people, to interrogate people, to kill people, this is part of what makes them victims, because they were forced to do these terrible things. And that does mean that the first narrative that every single person gave me was, I participated because I was forced to. This is also not an unusual explanation in any genocide. But the longer you talk to people and the more often you visit them again, the more you get to understand also other factors that I was mentioning earlier that play into that as well.
How are they perceived in society, the wider society? How are they also perceived as victims? And how are there some commemorations of the victims, and where is the place of perpetrators in that memoryscape?
This has changed quite strongly over time. Today, I would say there is a strong case for universal victimhood, is what I call it, where basically almost anyone can claim to have been a victim, mostly because the category of victimhood has nothing to do with our notions of ideal victimhood, maybe, sort of according to Christie. It's like this concept of what makes the ideal victim, but instead, it's very much to do with what loss you've suffered. So every perpetrator I spoke to had lost family members. They also suffered overwork, tiredness, hunger during the regime, and were fearful for their lives. And so they fit into a lot of the categories that other victims fit into too. And this is also broadly accepted across society. Not so much in individual communities where people were responsible for deaths within their own community. Here there is more animosity, but for the most part, people were transferred to other parts of the country and or other parts of their region at least, and they're not directly confronted with the people they victimized. And here this victimhood is much more accepted. But this was different in the 1980s, for instance, when there was still a civil war in the early 1990s, because the government very strongly demonized the Khmer Rouge as part of that, because they were in a civil war against the Khmer Rouge, who pulled back to the Thai border. And here, anyone who was associated with the Khmer Rouge was definitely not seen as a victim, but was seen as the evil other. And this then changed in the 1990s when there were amnesties offered through the win-win policy of Prime Minister Hun Sen. And then initial plans by the Prime Ministers the way he put it was to dig a big hole and bury the past in it. That didn't necessarily come to fruition. There's been a lot of transitional justice since. But in the end, today, it's transitioned into this much more inclusive victimhood perception, with very, very few, only the highest leaders being seen as the perpetrators, very much focused around Pol Pot and Yeng Seri as the sort of the core clique.
You mentioned the limited responsibility and also the process of transitional justice. So let's talk a bit about that, because there have been also some trials. There is the hybrid tribunal, the ECCC, but that's not without problems, of course.
Definitely. So, I mean, the transitional justice process in Cambodia has been, again, it's sort of different. There was a tribunal in 1979, few months after the Khmer Rouge fell, which has widely been decried as a show trial, but that focused responsibility very strongly already on the highest leaders. And again, the ECCC, there were years of negotiations between the Cambodian government and the United Nations. And in the end, one decided for a very narrow approach, not targeting too many individuals. And the first, so far, only three people have actually been sentenced at the tribunal. There would be further cases pending, but the Cambodian part of this hybrid tribunal, which is always staffed 50-50 or with a majority of Cambodians, is blocking any attempts to say that enough is enough. The highest leaders have been tried. We don't need to continue with the mid-level leaders. This has something to do with the fact also that members of the government are also implicated in some of the Khmer Rouge crimes before they defected, and then, you know, people who defected from the Khmer Rouge who then also toppled the Khmer Rouge and are now in power today. But the ECCC, what it has done is it has collected an amazing amount of evidence and documented the crimes, obviously from a judicial perspective, which doesn't resonate necessarily very strongly with wide parts of the Cambodian population. And sometimes I wonder whether a truth commission style transitional justice process could have been more helpful, particularly if you're only going to try a few people. But it has collected this evidence. And at the beginning, particularly, there was more outreach and there was much more of a wide appreciation of this. And the most innovative thing I would say about the ECCC is the fact that they included civil parties. So victims who could be civil parties to the trial, following sort of the French system on which the Cambodian judicial system is modeled. And this gave thousands of victims the chance to participate in the trials as actual plaintiffs. And this was at the time completely innovative in international transitional justice. Unfortunately, the civil parties weren't party to setting the agenda. They weren't part of deciding the framework of how they would participate or how the trials would be. And within the courtroom, they've been susceptible to a lot of limitations and being pushed into sort of a framework which is judicial, which is not necessarily how they would like to interact. So I would say there are severe limitations to civil parties. Also, who was able to become a civil party was strongly structured by who registered, and who registered were people mostly, most of the registration process wasn't done by the tribunal itself and their outreach, but through NGOs. So it was often in places these NGOs were working already, which is completely understandable, and they have limited resources. But at the same time, when talking about sort of equity of access, there are definitely problems there. But I think one of the biggest problems for the civil parties, and I've done since doing my perpetrator research, I've conducted a larger study with victims who are, many of them were also civil parties. One of the biggest issues is the idea of reparations. People assumed that if they were going to be civil parties, they would get reparations. And reparations are part of the program, but only symbolic and moral reparations, so at the collective level. And this is a big problem for people because they'd assumed and they'd hoped for individual level financial reparations. And it's interesting how, in my perception, the court presents these as people who just want to make profit off it. But actually, when you talk to them about why they want to have individual financial reparations, some people say it's to repair their houses or for healthcare, which honestly, basic human needs, which is quite understandable. But actually, also many people say that they would like it to be able to conduct ceremonies for their deceased loved ones who they're appearing at the tribunal for as civil parties, as part of a Buddhist religious to honor the spirits and to help them be reborn, particularly because many people haven't been cremated in Cambodia, so their spirits can't be reborn as part of the government politics of keeping bones so that show the world the tragedy of what happened. But these are all sorts of things which make the ECCC, yes, it brought justice to many people, and a survey we did showed that over 90% thought that justice had been, that the ECCC had contributed in some way to justice, but it also has a lot of problems with it as well. And part of that interesting fact, and then I'll stop talking about the ECCC, is that among these civil parties, many people, or several of them, are also former Khmer Rouge. So we have perpetrators who are legally clad as victims because they also suffered crimes, they also lost loved ones, and so on and so forth. And so obviously here we have complex political actors who are at once perpetrators, part of the system, part of the, they're people who implemented these genocidal policies, but are also on equal legal footing with people who were victims of the regime.
I would just ask you one more question about the ECCC, because I find it really interesting, the symbolic reparations. Could you just bring up an example of it? This is really interesting that there are reparations, but that they are symbolic and they take different forms of memory work and interventions in memoryscape in Cambodia.
So the types of programs that got reparation status, for many of them, they very strongly resemble what I would normally class as NGO dealing with the past programs. So we have organizations which have done therapy sessions, self-help groups, that was mandated as part. We've had, there was a play which was put on for school children. There was a traditional dance performance which took the topic of forced marriages and made a truly stunning art performance which was performed in Phnom Penh for some of the civil parties. There was the institution of a National Memory Day. These are the kinds of programs which were put on. There's an app on history. These kinds of things, and a memorial as well. But anything could be pitched as a collective reparation, as a moral reparation to the tribunal, and as part of the judgment, it was then pronounced or was rejected. And several of the civil parties I spoke to said that if an NGO prepares a suggestion, that is then accepted. But when the civil parties suggest something, they're always told this isn't going to work. And this is because most of the ideas they had, for instance, having free healthcare for people who were civil parties, infrastructure projects, or having a memorial in every province was one of the suggestions. They couldn't find funders because the NGOs are obviously, through the way they're structured and through institutional mentalities, they have ties to donors and they can get funding for this. Whereas the civil parties, unless they could find an NGO who said this is a great idea, couldn't find funding. And it's much easier for the German government to say, we will fund self-help groups or a dance performance, than it is to say we're going to build a concrete memorial in every province. They're much more tangible projects. But this isn't obviously how a farmer in Battambang province thinks. It's a disconnect between a lot of the more rural victims and some of the NGOs representing them.
Well, this is really connected to one of our conversation in one of the previous episodes with Lea David about her work on kind of the paradigm of dealing with the past, that victims who get organized in different associations and use this language of dealing with the past are more likely to succeed, unfortunately. And also what you just described really illuminates this problem of wider problem in more context, post-conflict context, that most of non-governmental organizations don't really work with socioeconomic justice as part of conflict transformation. I would ask you for the end, just can we really talk about reconciliation in Cambodia? Because reconciliation is usually perceived as the goal of all of these different efforts of memory, transitional justice, and dealing with the past. If it's based on universal victimhood and limited responsibility, can we call this reconciliation?
I would say yes, but my answer, and I think the answer of other researchers diverges. And I think that there are different perspectives on this. So I think that for the widest part, there is quite a strong degree of reconciliation. When you look at what happened in the late 1970s, the degree of reconciliation in the country, I think, is quite astounding, particularly when there are no numbers whatsoever on how many former Khmer Rouge there are in the country. But it's definitely higher than sort of anecdotal evidence would suggest. And so there are a lot of former Khmer Rouge out there, and there are relatively few conflicts today. This is partly due to the fact that there were some revenge killings in the immediate aftermath. So immediately some perpetrators were killed and many fled to the borders and have stayed there since the end of the civil war. So there's a physical divide. But even for the many, many people who are former Khmer Rouge, of the 58 people I spoke to, only one had any severe conflict with his community. And this was actually the only person who wasn't an official Khmer Rouge cadre. So he wasn't actually sent to a different part of the country. He was sort of militia adjacent. He was supporting the Khmer Rouge and was thus involved in some the arresting and detention of some people in his village who obviously resent this, but he was never formally part of the Khmer Rouge. So from that point of view, that actually strengthens the argument there is also something to be said that within Cambodian culture, there is a conflict aversion. So people don't necessarily like showing conflict. And so some people have said that reconciliation isn't particularly deep. And I do think that for some of the conflicts, this is the case. But given the vast magnitude of conflicts, which are potentially there could be, I do think that the relations are much better than one would expect. And this is due to this idea of universal victimhood. And the transitional justice has played into this. By only trying the highest leaders, it has supported this idea of universal victimhood. It supported this idea of very limited responsibility and has thus, while possibly not serving justice to the degree it could have done with more trials, I think it has serviced reconciliation.
Thank you, Tim, for sharing your insights with us. And I really hope that your model will really foster a better understanding of how low-level perpetrators were motivated in other contexts of genocides, including the Bosnian case, for example, in the post-Yugoslav space. So for non-BCS, so Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian speakers out there, you can also find our other episode in English with Mila Dragojevic about amoral communities and wartime violence against civilians on our website. This was Memory Cultures in Dialogue with Timothy Williams, the podcast of the Humanitarian Law Center.
Slušali ste podcast Fonda za humanitarno pravo.